You're listening to B2B Tech Talk, business-driven technology. Here's your host, Kimberly Durand.
Hi, I'm Kimberly. My guest is the fantastic Phil Simon, a no BS resource for anyone looking to make technology purchases for their business. He's written 3 books, probably more, but these are the ones I know about: Why New Systems Fail, The Next Wave of Technologies, and The New Small. So, Phil, I can see from everything you do, your books, your blog, all of your work, that you want to see companies successful with their technology purchases and their implementation. So, out of all the things that you see them doing, what makes you the most crazy?
Oh, gosh. Never ceases to amaze me how often people want precision and they expect it. And I understand that you can't write a blank check when you're implementing a new system. You want to know how much money you need to spend, and that's a given. But it is extremely difficult to predict with any sort of accuracy how long this is going to take. So it could be a very small gig, and someone says to me, hey, Phil, we want you to, you know, write some reports or do some data analysis or do some training or whatever, and say, how long will it take? And I ask them a bunch of specific questions to give them a proper estimate. Unfortunately, they don't know the answers a lot, so it makes it very difficult for me to sort of hit a moving target. So in many instances, and this is covered in Why New Systems Fail, they're what I call swags or strategic wild-ass guesses. You have sort of a general idea about how long something will take, but you really don't know until you get your hands dirty. So it isn't the most grating pet peeve of mine, but one of my big ones is this sort of expectation that you can predict it to the dollar, when in fact you have absolutely no idea. It's not uncommon for projects to be over by 40 or 60 or 100% or even more, and in large many times that actually stems from the fact that people picked the lowest number, when in fact the higher number might have been the lower number. It's just that the vendor that got the gig probably went in with a lower number, knowing that there were all sorts of ways to increase that number. So it leads to some sort of exceptionally contentious projects when it really doesn't have to be that way.
Well, you have so much experience working with different types of companies and different sizes of companies, and I assume you must see some patterns in the way that they make decisions, and some of those patterns are not helpful to them.
Oh, absolutely, and I think that it comes back to ultimately the principal agent problem or agency theory, and it's something that I've touched on at the end of The New Small, my third book. With regard to bigger companies, they have so many different parties. They all typically don't have the same interests. In fact, in many cases, they have a dichotomous interest. What one person wants, the other person specifically doesn't want. So you've got shareholders of different levels of management, different factions within the organization, and many times they're working at cross purposes. So as the consultant, I come in there, and it's not a matter of if I'm going to tick somebody off, it's just a matter of which person, because some people see me as an asset and some people see me as a liability because they have their own sort of political agendas. Now, that's not true across the board, and I've certainly worked over my career with very functional organizations that did things the right way. In fact, there's a post on my blog, Doing the Right Things and Doing Things the Right Way, or something along those lines, and it really does call out organizations that just get it. With regard to smaller companies, I really haven't had that problem in my career, which has really made writing The New Small just a joy. These are companies that really are avoiding the mistakes made by these bigger companies.
I think it's in Next Wave Technologies where you talk about the fact that a lot of people see IT like a utility company, and you wouldn't exactly invite the utility company in to help you figure out how to run your business.
Oh, sure, and I give credit where it's due. I mean, if you look at a book like The Big Switch from Nicholas Carr, he was really the person who termed it. And if you look at something like cloud computing, it's actually been around for a long time. It used to be called utility or grid computing. But, you know, long ago, companies realized that there wasn't a lot of sense in making their own electricity. And now many companies are realizing that there isn't a whole lot of value in maintaining their own servers or storage areas. So you're looking at companies like Rackspace or Amazon with the EC2, and they're saying, why don't we buy our computing power from them? And why don't we focus on running our business? So there is this shift underway with regard to the clouds, which very much ties into The New Small and what a lot of smaller companies are doing. They don't have the, you know, the money to spend on data centers. So why not find a company that does? And it's probably going to be more cost effective.
Another thing I want to point out is you talk in there about asking what IT's role should be in the organization. And one of your friends said, just stay out of the way.
Yeah, it was funny. I worked with the guy for about a year, And we got to be friends, and when I had asked him just for his thoughts on what IT should do, he was very busy. He works for a retail company, and he said basically get out of the way. And that's one of the chapters in the book that I wrote, and I don't have the right answer. Maybe this is the consultant in me. My opinions on things are very much a function of my work. In some companies, I've seen IT play a very hands-off role, and that's just what people came to expect. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong. And then in other instances, I've seen IT play a very sort of a dictatorial role. In fact, one client I worked at a couple of years ago, I can't name the name, I remember the IT director telling me very clearly he was uncomfortable with people even having access to Microsoft Excel. Well, how exactly are people supposed to analyze information? So that's another end of the extreme, and obviously I didn't agree with that one. I was there.
How were they analyzing information then?
The short answer is really they weren't. They had all Band-Aids out there, and again, that was one extreme example. So in that particular chapter, I believe it's chapter 3 in the book, I asked the question, what should be the right role for IT? And it's a function of a lot of things, budget, resources, culture, industry. That, again, is a very ambitious chapter, but I lay out, it's almost a sort of political thing. Are you a moderate, or are you on the far left or on the far right? I don't have the right answer, but I thought it was important to broach the question, because with the next wave of technologies, if you're thinking about open source software, right, and letting people experiment with things, that's all fine and dandy. But if your IT department locks things down so you can't get to a number of sites, you can't download, you can't install applications on your computer, well, then how can you possibly reconcile those two contradictions, right? Yeah. Open source may be all fine and dandy, but your company doesn't allow it, so something has to give. So I thought that it was really important to not just jump right into cloud computing or SaaS or business intelligence, but to provide a sort of intro as well as an outro. That way the technologies have context, which I think is really important. You can't look at these technologies in a vacuum. I think they all have to be considered against their backdrops, whether it's the type of organization, the industry regulations, the economic environment. In some cases, these technologies have been around for a while. Something like business intelligence is not new, but many organizations don't really do a whole lot with BI, while others are able to find out, and there are examples in the book, just some really amazing things from their data. So there's this opportunity out there, but if you can't get around to it, then you really are missing out.
Do you have any insight from being in the field about how IT departments perceive themselves and whether they feel comfortable telling the business side what opportunities they see?
I think it's really tough, and I certainly don't want to generalize, because for every example I bring up, someone else on listening is going to say, well, no, that's not true in our company. But if you look at IT budgets because of the economy, I was reading a statistic the other day online that they've actually reverted to their 2005 levels. IT in most organizations, in my opinion, is still really charged with keeping the lights on. And by that I mean handling security, servers, email, those kinds of things. And that's sort of a broader philosophical question. What should IT's role be? There are some people who believe that there shouldn't even be the name IT. It should really be business intelligence. The line should really drive things. In other words, if you work in marketing or sales or human resources, you should be the one figuring out which technologies you need. Now, you can't do that in a vacuum. IT needs to have some involvement in it, but, is IT the leader, or is IT more of an enabler? So it's a really difficult question. I can tell you, my current client, IT, is very much in sort of a support capacity. They will extract the information, but the way that technology has progressed, you no longer have to be a hardcore techie. Back in the mid-90s when I started working with enterprise systems, you really needed to be more of a programmer. You needed to code to extract basic information. Well, now, if you take a look at Crystal Reports or Business Objects or Microsoft Access, these are WYSIWYG tools. In many cases, they're wizards. So you can create basic reports to get at the information very quickly. And as more things move to the webs in a sort of software-as-a-service-based model, you don't even need to have proper applications installed. So if you look at, say, Salesforce.com, you just sign up for it, and maybe you need to be slightly technical to get the data into the system, but once it's in there, IT's role no longer has to be sort of the gatekeeper of the information. So I think it's a very dynamic time right now. There are still, I work a lot in hospitals. They're really on the sort of the right end of the technology adoption life cycle. They're kind of laggards. They're not really pushing the envelope. But for every laggard, you have, say, a startup company that just has a very sort of different role for IT. So it really does depend. It's hard for me to say what it is across the board.
Yeah, anybody who's curious about the drama, about the difficulty of transitioning to electronic medical records should check that out in your book.
Well, it's interesting because I always assumed, incorrectly as it turned out, that going to EMRs was really difficult. But when I was interviewing a dentistry practice down in Richmond, Virginia for the new small, they were explaining to me how they were able to do that very simply. Now, they weren't able to connect those health records with other hospitals and healthcare organizations, insurance companies, things like that. But just to get all of their data in electronic format was very simple. And it just was really interesting as I started to research these different companies. They were able to do some things just a lot simpler than the larger companies. They just didn't get in their own way.
Give us a few highlights from the next wave of technologies. What's in there that people really need to know?
Quite a bit. I'm smart enough to know that I'm not that smart. There's no way for me to write the definitive chapter on all of these technologies. So when I was conceiving of the book and talking to the publisher about it, I really wanted to bring in experts on these fields. So I wrote 7 of the chapters of the book, but then I found experts on things like business intelligence, master data management, social networks, cloud computing, enterprise risk management. I really wanted to compile a book that would give sort of a busy person, executive, director, IT person, really, one big resource. And it isn't a novel, right? So if for whatever reason you don't care about cloud computing, skip the chapter. You'll be sort of none the wiser. You have the ability to kind of pick and choose what makes sense, and you're really getting a tremendous amount of experience. I mean, I certainly know what these technologies are. I can answer questions about them, but I would not feel comfortable telling a CIO of a company how to use open source and some of the legal ramifications of that. So for that, I turned to a woman named Heather Meeker, who's an author and an intellectual property attorney out in California, who's probably forgotten more about open source than I'll ever know. So the book, I think, really has a number of different voices, but my role with regard to their chapters was really providing sort of a consistent tone. The problem with a lot of survey books is really twofold. A, they tend to be written in vastly different voices because they come from people, you know, the guy who wrote the chapter on mobility, Bhuvan Unkelar, is from Australia and is a PhD, and he's an incredibly smart guy. I've met him. But he writes in a very different way than I do, so I didn't want there to be this sort of drastic change when you read one chapter to another. The other point of the survey book really is at the end, once you've read the chapter on whatever, you have 10 or 12 bullet points or specific things that you ought to do. You've now read 15 or 20 pages on software as a service or cloud computing. Now what? What are you supposed to do with that information? So I really did want to make it, even though it's a big, thick, and relatively expensive book, I really wanted to make it chock full of information that wasn't just theoretical, but would then at least be a starting point, because obviously you can't write 15 pages and say everything there is to say about any of these technologies. In fact, each chapter could be its own book. So I tried to strike a balance between giving people an overview but also providing a number of specific things that they ought to be asking. So it's a very dense and ambitious book, and I'm very proud of it.
And let's also touch on your book, Why New Systems Fail, and some of the patterns you see in there. Tell us about the inspiration for that book.
Sure. There were really two sources of inspiration. First, it just was something I wanted to do. But beyond that, you know, anyone can write any kind of book, but I thought that there really was a need to put a book out there that explained the reasons that so many of these projects went astray. There just seemed to be something fundamentally wrong with implementing the kinds of systems, enterprise resource planning, ERP, and customer relationship management, CRM systems, that have really been around for a long time. The methodologies to implement these systems are very mature, even if the latest version of Oracle or SAP has just been released. Fundamentally, you're really trying to do the same thing. So after 10 years or so of working on projects that sort of had different degrees of dysfunction, I just said to myself, it's not me. I'm not the unlucky consultant on the world. And I would typically be thrown into projects, and I would say to myself, where did you come up with this number? What makes you think you can do this in 2 months? Or where do you get these figures? So it just seemed like there was something wrong with the process, and I really wanted to write a jargon-free book that would sort of demystify it and certainly wouldn't guarantee success, but would really honestly, in sort of in a vendor-neutral way, call out the mistakes that organizations tended to make. So it's the kind of book, quite frankly, that 10 years ago I would love to have read.
It's an excellent resource. You cover all the way from the concepts of the technologies through selecting a vendor all the way through to implementation.
And beyond, really. One of the things that I call out in the book, because not every organization, on the contrary, most organizations at any point aren't implementing a new system, but there's a type of failure in the book that I call, I think it's eventual failure or latent failure, something along those lines. Some organizations, because of the economy, because of some data issues, maybe some process issues, are so lean or have some sort of problems underneath the surface that at any point they could fail. So it wasn't just a matter of getting to the point of system activation or what some people would call going live. It really was about the maintenance aspect of it. How do you ensure that end users who leave jobs? I heard a statistic. I spoke at a conference a couple weeks ago for Dataflux, and the CEO of the company threw out a stat that something like 25% of all employees have been in their jobs less than a year, and 50% have been in their jobs for fewer than 5 years, which is an amazing statistic. And in most organizations, they don't have things documented terribly well. And let's be honest here, Kimberly, even if they are, when you know what hits the fan, you typically don't have time to read through a bunch of documentation to figure it out. You have to close the books. You have to get paychecks out. So there's a lot of unwritten knowledge there. So the book really goes beyond just the implementation. And I do think that, kind of like going to the doctor for a regular checkup, it's probably not a bad idea to do sort of regular audits on your systems and your people to make sure that the risks are really minimized.
Now, I want to also touch on your background, because you have some interesting experience that shapes your point of view about technology for business.
Sure. I mean, we're all really products of our environments, and when I speak, I typically tell people that this is where I'm coming from. I'm very much colored by my experiences as a consultant. If I had worked extensively in a systems capacity on the client side, you know, I probably wouldn't have the same breadth of experience, the same perspective. But my master's is, as you mentioned before, is in labor relations. So back in 1997, I started working in corporate human resources and quickly realized that it really wasn't where my strengths lay. I was really more of a technologist at heart, having gone to Carnegie Mellon and grown up in front of a computer. So over the course of a couple of different roles, I turned to a more sort of technical type of work. And then in 2002, I started independent consulting. So I don't really have the sort of traditional perspective of somebody who's worked at the same company for 10 years. I've seen companies make all sorts of mistakes from all sorts of different types of technologies. And when I was writing Why New Systems Fail, it just dawned on me, and this is actually on the back of the book, whether you're working for a 50,000-person multinational corporation or 150-person sort of startup firm, they actually were exhibiting very similar tendencies when implementing new technologies. So the whole point of the first book is that we really should be doing a better job implementing some pretty mature systems, which sort of fed into the second book. If we're not getting ERP and CRM right, then what does it say about our ability to effectively harness the power of social technologies, cloud computing, software as a service, mobility, et cetera, et cetera?
It can be a little scary, right?
Sure. I mean, it's kind of like not being able to hit your pitching wedge very well and expecting to crush your driver. I mean, the driver is a much more difficult club to hit for those of you who golf. And it just it struck me that we really didn't have a good series of examples to learn about how to take advantage of these really powerful and dynamic technologies. But if you don't understand them, then maybe people wouldn't be too eager to try them. But within this sort of chaos, and that's actually the subtitle of the book, Opportunities in Chaos, for the companies that did get it, they were able to take advantage of, you know, clouds and MDM and business intelligence and some of the other technologies mentioned in the book.
In part two of our conversation, Phil Simon shares insights from his newest book, The New Small, Small Agile Businesses Using Technology in Amazing Ways to Make Giant Business Leaps.
You've been listening to B2B Tech Talk. Visit our website at b2btechtalk.com.